Welcome, everyone, to the Friday night public discussion group of Perfecting Horizons Institute. We are in paper 49, section 2. We got into section 2 a little ways. We're on old single column, page 561. We are in that second subsection. We've got going through that list of seven different categories here, and we got through the first one last time. We're ready to start the second one. Before we jump in on that, let's just try to get ourselves back into this section. So it's entitled Planetary Physical Types. And they're just giving us some little thumbnail sketches of some of the physical variability that's in play with the mortals on worlds throughout the universe of universes. And you may recall they're also giving us the breakdown of the different flavors within each of these types within the local system. How many of the 619 worlds, percentage-wise, in our local system that we have so far, fall into the different flavors. And let's just remind ourselves of that very first sentence in that section where it said, there is a standard and basic pattern of vegetable and animal life in each system. Remember, you've got that basic benchmark fact so that if you have a spectrum of variation, one of the things you're looking for is that spectrum of variation very definitively centered on that standard type? And we saw that with the atmospheric types, where you had the so-called mid-breathers being just that, right in the middle of a spectrum of three different variations on atmospheric type, sub-breathers on one side, super-breathers on the other side, and the percentage was very extreme in the center, over 91% are mid-breathers, it said there, and just 2.5% on one side and 5% on the other side. It's a very, very narrow distribution centered on this standard that they're talking about. We pointed out that one of the obvious reasons that you're going to have a standardization like that is you're just going to have one genetic set of material sons and daughters that are going to be the means by which you're going to genetically, biologically uplift any world in that local system. So you could say that they have this very precise type of life that they want in a particular local system, and the material son and daughter are created by the creator son to match that, or you could think about it the other way around. It's a chicken and egg thing, really. It goes both ways. I mean, the whole point is that there's a definite purpose and plan that's being expressed in very precise fashion in each local system. So, in a case like this, where, and the atmosphere, okay, that's just the nature of that world. And so when they say over 91% are in the middle, what they're also telling you is if you go to the architectural worlds of this local system, the atmosphere is going to be like that, right? Another way to think about it is when you're talking about, a basic physical aspect of a world, of an evolutionary world, that physical aspect in the center of the distribution is what that physical aspect is basically like on the architectural worlds. So, it's mid-breather-like atmosphere, on all of the system headquarters worlds. Now, it's going to be a little different when we go to this next category, you'll see, that they're calling elemental types. That's much more of an evolutionary issue than it is just the nature of the world, you know, as an ongoing fact. So I'll bring that out as we get into it. You know, and we'll look as we go forward into the other ones, you know, which ones are, you know, have a very large number in a center of a distribution, which is then telling you something about what the architectural worlds are like, and which ones are more like this one that have a little bit more in play than just that distribution about the ideal in that local system for those physical characteristics. Okay.
Two, the elemental types. These differentiations have to do with the relation of mortals to water, air, and land, and there are four distinct species of intelligent life as they are related to these habitats. The rancher races are of the land order.
Okay, so, you know, just to set the stage, you know, obviously you don't have worlds that are nothing but air or nothing but water, you know, something like that. You know, so what exactly do they mean by this? And you notice right up front that it says there's four, you know, different flavors, you know, four distinct species of intelligent life, they're saying there. You know, just that it isn't like the other one, you had three, so you obviously had a center one. You know, you had an odd number, so there could be directly a central one. Here we have four different ones. So what exactly are they getting at here?
It is quite impossible for you to envisage the environment which prevails during the early ages of some worlds. These unusual conditions make it necessary for the evolving animal life to remain in its marine nursery habitat for longer periods than on those planets which very early provide a hospitable land and atmosphere environment. Conversely, on some worlds of the superbreathers, when the planet is not too large, it is sometimes expedient to provide for a mortal type which can readily negotiate atmospheric passage. These air navigators sometimes intervene between the water and land groups, and they always live in a measure upon the ground, eventually evolving into land dwellers. But on some worlds, for ages, they continue to fly even after they have become land-type beings.
Okay, so right, remember that you've got the basic pattern of the material sons and daughters, in our case, on Gerasim. Right? I mean, those are land dwellers. Right? They're breathing air, living on the land. Right? That's where all evolution is heading towards. No matter how different the world might be, it's all evolving towards something that is material son and daughter-like. Right? So they're just pointing out, right, that they're not telling you something that is about the end state of the world, right? But there's very definitively different means to that one end that differentiate one world from another. Like they're saying, for instance, you know, it always is starting in the water. And initially you've got marine animals, and then eventually they're going to be land animals, and eventually there's going to be will creatures. But they're pointing out on some worlds, it's a long time relative to what they're doing with the life unfolding before the conditions of the land and the atmosphere, or, you know, one or the other or both, get to the point where you can have land breathers like we are safely there, you know, this hospitable environment that they were saying there. And so it literally is the case that the animals evolve all the way to the point where you get will creatures in marine mammals. you know, before they go to land, so that the primitive humans on that world, you know, start in the water and eventually go to the land. You know, rather than, you know, like in our case, you know, animals were on the land for a long, long, long time before you got Andon and Fonta, right? But see, that's the key. It's, you know, we went from land to water too. I mean, that's not the issue. It's whether or not you actually get to the point of having will creatures when they're still in the water. Yeah?
There are going to be vast variations between evolving planets that are in the process of terraforming.
Okay, I mean, by the time, you know, the planet is essentially terraformed, you know, by the time you initiate eukaryotic life.
Correct.
Right? The question is, they're telling you there's all kinds of variations on the how physical evolution on a planet rolls out. And something we certainly don't understand in any way, all kinds of variations about what's the best way to initiate life relative to that physical evolution. You know, and it's just interesting to know, it's like, they don't always, you know, it isn't always best to make it so that the life doesn't go to will creature until the animals are on the land. You know, you can say, well, you know, so it takes a long time before they get to land relative to, say, us. You know, well, why don't they just make the life so that it doesn't go to will creature until they're on the land? But apparently that's not the best thing to do for, you know, reasons that are completely beyond our comprehension.
Otherwise, it would happen that way.
Right. Otherwise, you're right. The life, yeah, because the life carriers are planning all this, right? So it, you know, they know what's best for a given world, and so they're just telling us it's best sometimes if it actually gets to will creature status while they're still marine. Now, as they'll tell you, we're not talking about human fishes here, right? I mean, you know, material sons and daughters aren't birds or fishes, or, you know, they're mammals, right? They're bipeds,
large.
Right? Right. So, I mean, humans are always mammalian, even if they go through a stretch where, you know, they're in the air or in the water, as will creatures. Okay. So that issue, they'll expand on that a little bit more.
Humans in Satini or humans everywhere?
Humans everywhere are mammalian and electrochemical based, and yeah, I mean that's.
I mean, I don't know if I got that far. Are you sure it's all over the entire super universe?
Yeah, I mean,
but are they all? It's hard. They're not totally clear on that, are they?
Well, I mean, it's not like there's a statement that just directly tells you that, but if you consider all the various things they say, it's just like recognizing that it's all electrochemical based, you know, in the sense that we think of, you know, you don't have, you know, silicon-based life forms, you know, as opposed to carbon-based life forms or some science fiction thing like that. I mean, it's, you know, you got to remember that because the universe is designed, I mean, oxygen doesn't just happen to be something that our kind of life coincidentally can use. The only reason oxygen exists is for it to be used like we see it being used. I mean, that's the purpose of oxygen, you know, and the purpose of carbon. You know, it's not a coincidence that carbon has all of this variability to make organic molecules where other atoms don't. That's the reason that carbon exists. It's created to be the basic atom that you're building the molecules of life out of. That's, you know, all of the atoms are not just energy, they're power, right? They're not just an actuality, they're a reality. They're patterned energy, they're purposed energy. You know, every atom has a very precise purpose that reflects the pattern of the Isle of Paradise. So that, you know, that that's what's so fundamentally different about the universe we're reading about here compared to a science fiction universe. You know, where the initial assumption of science fiction is you just randomly have matter and coincidentally, you know, it can collect together and make living things, you know, by some magical, mysterious reason. Right? You know, I mean, that's the cool thing that you'll begin to discover when you get on the Mansion Worlds and, you know, up to Gerasim is technetium has some unique purpose that you can't have supremacy without it. Right? You know, or, you know, fermium, you know, element 100, or, you know, all 100 of those elements aren't just, you know, some random things. There's somehow they have a unique, indispensable role. I mean, gold isn't just to make shiny objects. What exactly is the purpose, you know, in a greater sense of gold? I mean, obviously, it's going to play a temporary role on evolutionary worlds, you know, as a raccoon enticing shiny object.
Right? Looks like it,
too. Right? I mean, it obviously is going to be universally used like we've used it. But to understand what its, you know, what its place is in supremacy, you know, where does it fit into the big picture? Right. So, all right. Anyway, back to this. So you've got this. You've got the option that maybe it actually goes to will creatures while they're still marine, and then like they're saying. See, these air navigators sometimes intervene between the water and land groups. See, again, you're going from water to land, but it might not be directly. Sometimes there actually is a step where it goes to air navigators, and those air navigator animals cross the human threshold at some point. And so the first will creatures are air navigators. You know, Red Man, you know, is an air navigator, you know, initially on those worlds. And then, you know, if they have all six, you know, Orange Man and then Yellow Man, etc. Right?
So on this smaller world, would the atmosphere be thicker, be easier for them the air to hold them up?
Right. I was just gonna say that, right? So, you know, you've got all these variations of sizes and gravity, and you know, we'll get to that stuff here in a little bit. But you know, you notice how this fits in nicely after what we just read in the previous one. The fact that you've got super breather worlds, you've got worlds with a much higher density atmosphere, obviously a much heavier creature could be airborne, you know, especially if the gravity was lower. If the gravity was lower and the atmosphere was denser, right, you could get a human-sized thing, you know, being an air navigator, you know, quite easily. Now, of course, you know, we know that there's a physics to this that is kind of beyond our current understanding because there's fan doors, right? So this isn't as hard to get a human-sized creature as an air navigator as current science would think, right? Yeah. But still, you can see the obvious, you know, that's why they said, you know, that, you know, where did they say that about... conversely, on some worlds of the super breathers. I mean, that's obviously the greater tendency is on a super breather world for you to have these air navigators that go to will creatures.
Yeah. I just find it curious that they directly say eventually evolving into land dwellers. I think how many ages did we wish we could fly and think that would be? Yeah. That, it seems... And if you were a creature who could fly, and you're evolving to a land dweller, mm-hmm. it's like there would be a tension there of having to give, you've got something to give right. up.
Well, or so you think from your biased perspective, right? For those of you on the webinar, if you didn't pick that up, you know, he's saying, you know, it's like, well, you know, we yearn to be able to fly, you know, and here's these ones that fly naturally, and then eventually they have to, you know, quote unquote, clip their wings and have a civilization on the land. But you notice that last comment, but on some worlds for ages they continue to fly even after they have become land-type beings. So there are going to be some worlds that will be kind of, you have some science fiction stories kind of along that line, you know, where they're basically land dwellers with a civilization, but coincidentally have wings and, you know, and they do some flying too.
Yeah.
Because they came from Krypton. If it's any consolation, we're great error navigators.
Okay, but all right, you know, but just the key to remember is how this is obviously very different than the previous one. We're talking about the evolutionary process, you know, creating this differentiation, as opposed to just the sort of final settled state of the world, you know, being the differentiator. All right. Okay, let's see, I think that got everything there, didn't we? So then they make get a little bit more on them here.
It is both amazing and amusing to observe the early civilization of a primitive race of human beings taking shape. In one case, in the air and treetops, and in another, amidst the shallow waters of sheltered tropic basins, as well as on the bottom, sides, and shores of these marine gardens of the dawn races of such extraordinary spheres. Even on Urantia, there was a long age during which primitive man preserved himself and advanced his primitive civilizations by living for the most part in the treetops, as did his earlier arboreal ancestors. I knew there'd be a word I couldn't do. And on Urantia, you still have a group of diminutive mammals, the bat family, that are air navigators, and your seals and whales of marine habitat are also of the mammalian order.
Yeah, so that last little bit, you know, there, you know, that's not an explanation of, you know, those air navigators aren't, you know, human-sized bats, you know, or those marine dwellers on those worlds, you know, aren't, you know, whales or something, right? I mean, that's not obviously the point. But they are, you know, reminding you that don't be surprised if on a decimal world, where you have a very vast spectrum of creatures that come into existence, you know, that you would see mammals of some type populating, you know, air, land, and sea. Right? Now that's the point they're getting at, that you can see from that that it is naturally part of the evolutionary system that that potential is there, even though obviously it wasn't designed to go forward, you know, to some human-like level on this planet. That wasn't the plan on this world. You know, it's not a coincidence that, you know, you didn't get sentient or will creatures that were in the air or the sea here. You know, that was not the plan. Yeah.
Obviously, it tells us about a number of beings that evolved in a different manner and different types of planets, blah, blah, blah. But the... I don't know. Does it happen as quickly? I mean,
there's as many variations as there are worlds, you know, and there's trillions of worlds in the universe of universes. So, all right, I mean, every variation conceivable is going to happen somewhere.
But they tell us nothing about the other types of species that will be habitating the worlds. They only refer to the human.
Right. I mean, they give you little passing references to the animal diversity. You know, I mean, we'll read that here in a little bit. I mean, again, because we're a decimal world, there's a lot greater variability, right, of animal species here. Now, another thing, you know, to just think about there, you know, with this, is that. You know, if it actually is the case that, as they were saying, that the land and atmosphere environment is not hospitable, you know, so that you have will creatures that are in the sea. Wow. I mean, okay, they can't be like a seal or a whale, right, where they go up to get that bad air, right? I mean, if the case is that the air is not yet appropriate, right? It can't be a mammal like that has the surface for air, right? So you can see, you know, in some cases, you know, you're going to have something that we really don't have here, right? Something that can get its oxygen out of the water, right? Doesn't have to get it out of the air, right? So there's going to be lots of variations, but as they're about to say, you know, again, they're not, you know, human fishes. because of that. Because, fishes aren't mammals. Birds aren't mammals. Right? Adam and Eve are mammal, a mammalian. Right?
Legs and stuff? I mean, they're going to be biped?
Yeah, everything. I mean, because again, I mean, Adam and Eve can't mate with octopi, right? Right, and again, you know, it's like, you know, in science fiction, anything goes, right? You can have, you know, you can imagine, you know, sentient everything, right? But no, I mean, they've got to be something that can mate with an Adam and Eve.
Right? But they vary their shape too.
Right, but only, you know, minimally, right? See, I mean, again, there's the whole point is that the universe is not as radically variable as science fiction imagines it, yeah. Right? The reason science fiction imagines all the variability is because they don't think there's any purpose, that it's just a random bottom-up phenomenon. No, there's one very precise type of creature that's being expressed, right? I mean, and, you know, and if you want to, you know, another way to think about how, you know, there can't be that much diversity of Adam and Eve's, and hence diversity of will creatures, Melchizedek's, right? You know, we talk about them. You know, they can manifest themselves materially, and they have that variability, right? I mean, when they manifest, you know, you could tell when we read about Melchizedek's, it's not like there's 500,000 different types of Melchizedek's, and when some of them manifest materially, they look like octopi, right? This is not, obviously not what's going on. I mean, there's one type of Melchizedek, right? And they can just manifest themselves materially, right? They don't morph into a different thing. They're one form. It's just that, you know, it's just like we talked about, you know, a secondary midway where he makes himself visible. It's not like when he was invisible to us, he was something completely different shaped or anything. He's exactly the same shape as he is when he makes himself visible. He's got the same, you know, veins and arteries and, you know, and everything, nerves and stuff when he was invisible. I mean, he doesn't manifest, you know, he doesn't manufacture something out of nothing.
He's not a shapeshifter.
Right? Right, it's not some sort of a shapeshifter, some sort of a magical sort of a thing. Right? That when he was invisible, he was a cat, and when he was, you know, when he's visible, he looks like a human or something. No, that's his form. You know, so if a Melchizedek manifests, right, they're not, you know, shapeshifting, quote unquote. Right, they're just making their form materially manifested. Right, and what happens when they materially manifest themselves sometimes, when they're a Melchizedek life carrier, they mate with an Eve, biologically, right? I mean, that's telling you that fundamentally a Melchizedek is just like us, basically. Only normally their energy system is not visible to us. But if he makes it so that it's, you know, like this, you could mate with him if you're a female. Right? I mean, they're, you know, see, so it's that sort of recognition, you know, that the Adam and Eve, you know, they are just the downstepped expression of basically the type of form of most creatures, you know, that is just stably always a physical manifestation and can't vary that. Right? It's kind of more like you have one type of creature, but you just make that creature with different energy systems. You take me and just use a different energy than these molecules to make me out of, and then I would be a Melchizedek, right? You know, or a secondary midwayer. That's the amazing thing, see, that you're recognizing that you have a particular form and it's just downstepped, right? But it's really all the same type of form. At different levels of energy expression or manifestation. Mm-hmm. Okay. All right, so now back to this. You know, it is both amazing and amusing. Right? You know, just think about it. I mean, think about how difficult it would be to get a very sophisticated civilization going, you know, if there's a high degree of error or marine to your, you know, day-to-day, you know, existence. You know, I'd like to set a stack of papers on my desk, right? But the waves are sloshing. Amusing.
Yeah.
Right? You know, yeah, I mean, so, I mean, obviously this can't go very far. It's got to stay pretty primitive, right? You know, or it would just be hopeless, right? To try to do it if there's too much air or water. I mean, they're trying to get you to reflect on why are material sons and daughters land creatures? Because you can't have advanced civilization in the water or in the air, right? Right? There's a purpose to land. There's a purpose to gravity, right? It allows you to have a stack of papers on a desk and they stay there. They stay in the inbox and don't float into the outbox or simple things like that. Bureaucracy would be really tough, you know, in the sloshing tidal region, right, of a lagoon.
Okay. I had it a second ago.
I appreciate it.
You know, and yet they're will creatures. They have creativity. Right? Amazing. Yeah. You know? Just think of the creativity that gets manifested on some of those worlds. How creative some of these creatures are. It's like they are driven to be more and more civilized by nature. That's the way we're designed. And so they would, until they become land dwellers, they would be pushing the envelope on clever ways to do things that we never would think of. Right? Because again, where there's a will, there's a way, right? Now, when there's no will, no.
No way.
Animals, you know, don't have this creativity. But where there's a will, there's a way. And so that's the amazing thing, is to actually see that on different worlds, what creative schemes they would come up with to get some sort of a primitive civilization going. All right. Let's see, what else we have there? You notice with it's not just air and treetops for the air navigators, but on the marine ones, it's not just the shallow water sort of a thing. But, you know, they start out, they have stuff down to the bottom, you know, of the basin, up the sides of the basin, you know, then in the shallow area, and even starting to dribble up onto the shore some. You know, see, so they're pointing out that there's a transition. You know, instead of just having the animals coming out and being onto the shore, like our first land animals did, you know, you actually have a civilization that starts to, you know, penetrate up onto the shore, and then eventually all the civilization, you know, moves up on the land. But so it's just kind of fast. You know, I'm sure it's amazing, you know, to observe that happening. That kind of what we think of as very primitive evolution, having civilization along with the ride.
Sure. So.
Let's see. What else do we have here? Yeah, okay, and then just that one little thing about arboreal ancestors. They point that out again. You know, think about the context when they say something like that. They aren't just saying, oh yeah, and completely off topic, you know, remember, you know, that the early Andonites, you know, spent a lot of time in the trees. Yeah, they're just reminding you that, again, that's inherent in the system in general. That on some worlds, that's very definitively manifested, you know, that the air navigators are very tree-oriented in their early civilization. Yeah, so that's the point, is just to appreciate that on this decimal world, you can actually see hints of what would go further on other worlds, okay? Try to think about what's the truth of that statement that they're telling there, not just the fact of it, that the Andonites lived in trees. There's a truth to that, that the system inherently has that potential to produce will creatures that are comfortable in the trees. And on some worlds, that's fundamental. You know, they don't get up into the trees from the ground up. They get into the tops of the trees from the air down, right, as will creatures.
But in both cases, it's primarily protection.
Protection, right. Yeah, I mean, obviously, it's beginnings of the security,
yeah,
you know, issue, right? Yeah. All right, and they got one other little statement here.
In Cetania, of the elemental types, 7% are water, 10% air, 70% land, and 13% combined land and air types. But these modifications of early intelligent creatures are neither human fishes nor human birds. They are of the human and prehuman types, neither superfishes nor glorified birds, but distinctly mortal.
Okay, I've already been stressing that. So there you get the percentage breakdown. Now, and you see, okay, you do see the fact that the big number, the 70%, is the land. Which, yeah. So even though it, you know, it's not quite like the other ones I was telling you, where you have a central one and then it tails off to each side, you know, it's not surprising. Adam, material sons and daughters are land dwellers, so it's not surprising that the greatest percentage would be land dwellers. That's the whole point. They're only going to be marine or air, you know, or some combination if the life carriers can't do it purely as land. You know, the land is the rule. Everything else is an exception to that rule. And this, the fourth one is very fascinating, that 13% combined air and land types. What does that mean? Okay. In other words, you're going to have some, remember, normally you have the six Sangic races, not all at the same time, but, you know, first you have Red Man, and then sometime long after that, you know, us as a separate phenomenon, Orange Man comes into existence out of the prehuman stock, and then way out, you know, it's spread out over a long span of time. And they're pointing out that on some worlds, some of the Sangic races, you know, go to a will creature. You know, you have prehuman Red Man, and then you have human Red Man. You know, at some point, you have human Red Man as a land dweller, but others of the Sangics might be air. You know, so you could obviously imagine maybe it starts out, the early ones start out as air, but the planet is evolving, and by the time you start to get, you know, by the time you want to have Indigo Man, say, right, they don't have to be an air navigator, and they can just be on the land. So, right, so they're pointing out that some worlds, it actually, you get some of each. Some of them go will creature on land, some go will in the air.
But this is more like of traversing and everything, because obviously, you know, if they're eating, they're not growing anything in the air. They're not living in the air, just sitting there with nothing to sit on or something to gather.
Right, that's why they said in the air and treetops, right? I mean,
yeah, what I mean, so I mean, yeah, so what we're talking about is more the way they navigate versus, you know, the way they, you know, they live. I mean, anybody who's in the air is going to end up on the ground at some point.
Right. Well, you know, right. But fundamentally, they're saying that
so
there's.
So if they're going to have to cultivate, at some point they're going to have to.
Right. See, obviously, you're not going to get agriculture while they're still marine or air, predominantly. Right. I mean, that's only going to happen once it gets to, you know, full land dweller in the evolutionary thing. But see, the whole point is, you've got something that's not a bird, but it's like a bird. You know, the bird isn't fundamentally something that lives on the land. You know, normally. And then occasionally flies, right? I mean, it's fundamentally something that flies and then lands in a treetop or on a cliff side or something every once in a while, right? To form a nest or whatnot.
Right? All the birds I know walk on the earth, too. You know, they may not walk
right,
fast,
right. But the whole point is, you know, we're not talking about something like a penguin, you know, that fundamentally lives on the land,
right?
We're talking about something like a seagull, right? You know, or an eagle. An eagle doesn't fundamentally live on the land like a penguin does,
or
something, right? Mm-hmm. That's they're trying to say that you've got animals, you know, that go through the whole process. Eventually, evolve mammals, you know, and these mammals are basically air dwellers, right? They obviously nest in treetops and stuff like that, but they're basically an air animal, a mammal, pre-human, and at some point. Two of those pre-humans, you know, give birth to the first pair of humans.
Anadon and Fanta.
Right? They're quote-unquote Anadon and Fanta. You know, they're, you know, and normally it's going to be two red men. I mean, so you have two red pre-humans, you know, that basically are flighted mammals, you know, and one day they give birth, you know, to the first will creature, red man, who are also flighted mammals. Right, that's the point, right? Yeah, it's all just, you know, it's just when the whole point is when you cross the will threshold line. When does it go beyond the fifth adjutant? Right?
Yeah.
All right. Let's see, anything else there? You notice that, you know, on the one side, the water and the air, you have 7 and 10, so you have 17%. On the other side, you have 13. You know, it is kind of interesting. You can see why the way they listed them that, you know, you have kind of about the same amount on each side of the 70%. So there's some pattern there, I'm sure.
Why would they say distinctly mortal rather than distinctly mammalian?
You'll see that right here, they're wanting to use the word mortal in that mode. I mean, obviously, super fishes and glorified birds would be mortal too. They wouldn't be immortal super fish. I've pointed this out many times. The word mortal is used in a very diverse mode. Sometimes it's a synonym, you know, for will creature. You know, if they're saying the ascending mortals in Havona, right? They don't mean that those mortals literally could die and never, you know, you're completely immortal when you're in Havona, going through Havona, you know. So there it means one time ascending mortals, you know. You could ask yourself, why do they do that? Why do they kind of key on that word mortal to use in such a diverse set of ways? Sometimes they mean it literally, sometimes they don't at all. You got to figure out by the context. Of all human fears, what's the greatest fear?
Death.
Mortality. Right, mortality. Right, that's fundamentally why they're doing that. They're, you know, that whole bit about you being mortal, right? You don't have great fears about salamanders being mortal. Right? That isn't a big issue. That's why they're doing it. They're just keying on the fact that animals are sort of just what humans are built upon. The whole point is, you know, worlds aren't created for animals. You know, no world has life on it except that there be will creatures. That's the whole point of having a world, right? Is to have will creatures. Those, and again, it reminds you that things are not coming bottom up, right? Humans are a downstepped expression. These mortals are downstepped expression of immortal forms, right? You take a Melchizedek that's an immortal form, you downstep it, and it becomes mortal, right? See, so those are the mortals. You know, so basically, they're kind of using mortal as an adjective there when they just say distinctly mortal. You know, mortal creature, right? And there's basically one type of creature in the local universe that just exists at various levels. And if you downstep it down too far, it becomes a mortal creature, right? As opposed to a Melchizedek creature, or a Lamanadec creature, or an archangel creature, or a secondary midway creature, or, you know, you basically just have a certain creature in a local universe at various levels.
And on the planetary level, it's according to the adjutants that they're utilizing, the degree.
Right. I mean, down here, right? I mean, when they say mortal, they mean a 7 adjutant phenomenon. Yeah. All right, so let's go to the next one. Now, you know, we alluded to this a little bit about gravity a minute ago here. So here's the gravity thing.
3, the gravity types. By modification of creative design, intelligent beings are so constructed that they can freely function on spheres both smaller and larger than Urantia, thus being, in measure, accommodated to the gravity of those planets, which are not of ideal size and density.
Okay, just one little comment to make there. Notice how they threw in both size and density to remind you of the complexity of it. It isn't just a size issue, right? You could have a world that's larger than ours, but if the mean density of the world is a lot less than ours, right? You know, you got to factor in the density as well as the size, right? So, they're just reminding you that it's not like every world ends up having the same amount of iron or whatever, that our world has. I mean, the density varies a lot from world to world. Okay, even in our solar system, there's a lot of variation of the density of of the non-gaseous planets and moons in the system. Right? So you combine the size and the density, and you have a certain gravity, and they have to take that's one of the major things that they have to take into account. We're going through the list of the major issues here. What else do they say?
The various planetary types of mortals vary in height, the average in Nebadon being a trifle under 7 feet. Some of the larger worlds are peopled with beings who are only about 2.5 feet in height. Mortal stature ranges from here on up through the average heights on the average-sized planets to around 10 feet on the smaller inhabited spheres. In Satania, there is only one race under 4 feet in height. 20% of the Satania inhabited worlds are peopled with mortals of the modified gravity types occupying the larger and the smaller planets.
Okay, so here you see one like the atmosphere, right? So 80% are in the middle, not modified really. In other words, 80% of the worlds basically have a gravity like the architectural worlds. Well, the M class, has a lot to do with atmosphere and right. If you're thinking Star Trek, yes. So again, you see the whole point is they're basically looking for worlds that are like the architectural worlds, with a little bit of variation away from that ideal, if you will, that center point. Remember how we talked about that? That doesn't matter if Gerasim is 100 times the diameter of the Earth; the gravity is basically the same as the Earth. Right? I mean, so we already know that Earth-like gravity is the middle of the spectrum here. Right? And there's going to be some that are some have less gravity, some have greater gravity, and it's like, well, I mean, why vary the height? Why not really? Vary the internal nature of the creature. So they could all be basically the same height. Like maybe you could fundamentally vary their density. That's like we were talking about the planets having variable density. But you see, that's not how it works. Why? Because there's basically one way to make a human. Right? You don't have variability there. You can't really make higher density and lower density humans. They're made out of the same carbon, organic molecules that we're made out of on every world, right? So in order to, and obviously if you're going to have something that, a creature that could produce a non-amusing civilization, right, you can't have a situation where everything is always on the verge of kind of floating off the ground a little bit, right? You need to be able to stably walk as a civilized creature, right? And so if the gravity is lighter, they make you taller so that you have the same sort of tangible, contactable relationship with the ground you're walking on that you know.
That idea of what you just said about that they're not going to bury the mortal supports the earlier statement you made about because it's all aiming toward Adam and Eve life. There's just upstepped. So they're going to bury all these other things.
Not only is it like that. That's an appropriate way to think about it. That it's all being aimed toward creatures that are Adam and Eve like. But on the other hand, there's no waste in the universe. God has one plan, not many. God has one plan. Right? And God didn't make any stuff that doesn't have something to do with that plan. Right? It's not possible to make radically different humans, you know, say in density, because there is no plan for such a thing. So coincidentally, you can't do it. Right? I mean, the life carriers didn't design the overarching plan. They're just functioning within it. And they go, well, coincidentally, this is all the materials we have to work with, and this is the only way the materials can go together. So only certain worlds can be made to have will creatures on them. You know, when all is said and done, you'll be able to look back and say, you know, that one world, it was close, but it just, you know, even with the variability we had in creatures, we couldn't make one on that world. In Supremacy, you'll look back and you'll understand why. Why that world is not there in Supremacy. You know, it's not like you'll get to the Supremacy and, you know, and there'll be these excess worlds. Right? Are there excess worlds in Havona? No. Right? There will be no excess worlds or even dirt clods, you know, floating in space when all is in the grand universe is settled in light and life. There won't be a single meteor or comet or, you know, or gas giant or anything that has no point, you know, in the whole, the only reason worlds exist when all is said and done is to be the place for will creatures to live. That's the whole point. Right? So, you know, everyone is just working within one grand plan where they don't see the end from the beginning like the master architects do. But when we all get to the end, we'll all go, huh, look at that.
Yeah.
It all worked out.
I always considered it was like you lay the infrastructure down first. So, of course, the architectural spheres will all go in first. And of course, the infrastructure, and then come the planets, the dirt balls, but where we come forth from. But we are not architectural spheres. We were naturally formed through the normal process. Mm-hmm. But I had it all mixed up. I thought that they were building the worlds first. The architectural spheres, then the worlds.
And again, of course, you know, the evolutionary worlds are not built. They evolve into existence, and coincidentally, certain ones of them evolve and end up being tweakable so that they can be made just like an architectural world. Right? I mean, that's the whole point. The architectural worlds are the end from the beginning.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's what everything is evolving toward.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. In the same way that you know that the Supreme Being already exists, even though from our time viewpoint he doesn't exist, you know, from the eternity viewpoint he has to already exist, because how could there be Magistan, or how could there be, you know, his deputies, you know, the unqualified supervisors of the Supreme. Right, you have many things that are the antecedent following, right? The end from the beginning. And the architectural worlds are like that. Okay, let's see. So, yeah, anyway, so just I was going to stress. See, that you have the basic gravity that you want, and then there's modifications from that. The way they say that, peopled with mortals of the modified gravity types. See how they're speaking about it. You're starting with what's on the architectural worlds, and you're varying as far as you can in any direction from that center point. All right. Just the one other little thing. You know, think about how high the gravity must be on those worlds where the mortals are only 2.5 feet in height. Right? You know, so just 2.5 feet, you know, but they're going to have the same sort of tactile experience as they walk that you do. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the whole point. The way you interact with the ground because of the level of gravity that's here.
At some point, we were 2.5 feet.
Right?
And
And, you know,
may not be as fat,
and because you were 2.5 feet, your dad could go, wee, you know, and throw you up in the air and stuff. But no, we're talking about adults. Right, so think how little the kids are. Right, when the adults are 2.5 feet. Right, just think how tiny those, when those babies are born, you know. Yeah.
Of course, not to change the topic by any means, but all of 99% of the sightings of UFOs that have been seen, all of the beings are these little guys.
Right. And so, right. We'll get to that in a minute.
Tell you what about the planet they come from. What we just learned. What does it tell you?
Ah, yes, that's very close. We would be shocked.
No. What does that mean? Is that going to be a big planet or a little planet if they're 2.5?
Maybe a little.
Right. If you're,
it'd be a large planet.
You know, if supposed, you know, if supposed aliens are short, what he's trying to get you to do is apply what we just learned.
It's gonna be huge.
You know that the planet they came from. No, not the planet's not necessarily huge or smaller. The gravity is greater. One way or another, the gravity is greater on their world. Right. They, you know, again, the point is, if you see a tall alien. Right? It's not. It isn't just because randomly on that planet, the mortals are tall. Nothing is random.
Gravity is lighter.
Right. You know that alien would have had to have come from a world where the gravity was less.
The guy that just came back from space grew a few inches.
Yeah. Well, there's that issue. You're right. You know, if you're
seriously,
if you're not in gravity, your spine stretches out again. Yep.
Yeah.
Okay.
We're way down for the planet we're on.
Now, just one other thing to keep in mind here. So it can get as small as 2.5 feet, but why does it only go up to 10? You know, around 10. Why doesn't it go beyond that? Well, a couple papers from now, we're going to read about material sons and daughters. Material sons and daughters range from 8 to 10 feet. Right? So just notice how it works, that the evolutionary creatures max out in height with the material sons and daughters. Does that make sense from what I was just saying a minute ago? That you have a phenomenon that's fundamentally a downstepping phenomenon, right? Right. If you just minimally downstep material sons and daughters, they basically, those creatures are the same height. But if you downstep them more and more and more, they get shorter and shorter and shorter and shorter, right? There can't be ones that are taller, because then how would that be a downstepped expression of a material son and daughter? Right?
Unless that particular world had giant strains and some of them
might. Right. But now the other thing, you know, we also see what I've tried to remind you of many times, right? You got some worlds where they're only 2.5 feet tall. You know, the adults on that world. So when an Adam and Eve go to such a world, obviously you're not going to have, you know, even if they're only the 8 foot tall Adam and Eve, you're not going to have 8 foot tall, you know, Adam and Eve directly mating with 2.5 foot tall evolutionary mortals. That's going to be a problem.
They just run away from them.
Okay.
No, their kids are going to have to.
Right. No, there's going to be issues, you know, simple birthing issues, you know, and space issues, right? Right? You can't fit the child of an 8 foot creature in the womb of a 2.5 foot mother. Right? There'll be issues. Right. So again, it reminds you that fundamentally, you know, when they tell you the material sons and daughters don't mate directly, that's why. You know, the material sons and daughters are downstepped a little bit when they're made in Adam and Eve in a world, so that when they have children, those children are the proper stature and whatnot to match the creatures. And it's not just height. All these variations we're talking about, right? They've got to make it so that Adam and Eve birth children that match up with whatever it is on that world. There's a very dynamic downstepping thing that's going on between the Adam and Eve and their children on some worlds. Because there's a huge difference.
That makes it more amusing and amazing.
Is that taking place before they get here?
No, I mean, they leave, like in our case, they leave Gerasim, the material son and daughter pair, leave Gerasim just as they were on Gerasim. But when they are rematerialized, they explain this, when they're rematerialized on the world, they're downstepped a little bit so that primarily when they procreate, they give birth to mortals. Okay? But there's all these other things in play too. See, the life carriers, when they rematerialize them, modify them so that when they procreate, they produce children that can mate with the evolutionary creatures on the planet, whatever those details are.
Especially
now, I mean, they obviously don't make them so they exactly match right. The material creatures, because the whole point is to upstep the material, you know, the evolutionary creatures, right? But, you know, they have to be basically compatible.
Doesn't the Book of Enoch talk about giants mating with them?
Well, I mean, there's all those histories. We all know about the, you know, the giant men of old, you know, the mighty men of old, you know, when the giants walked the earth, right? You know, remember, the Revelation talks about why that is. You know, it's because of the legends of the Noddites and the Adamites, you know, as being fundamentally taller than the evolutionary stocks.
Mighty men of old.
Okay. All right, so just, you know, this starts to really remind you of that when you say 2.5 feet. It's like, you know, so that, you know, let's say they're 8-foot Adam and Eve on that world. They're designed so that they give birth to children that mature to 2.5 feet high. Those Adamites on those worlds have to be, you know, or maybe they're 3 or 4 or something. I don't know. You know, maybe they upstep it a little bit, right? But they've got to be, their children have to be compatible with 2.5 foot tall creatures.
Right. Wow. You sure save on diapers with that.
And it reminds you of how much, you know, which came first, the chicken or the egg, right? The egg, right? It's just that one day, what came out of that egg was a chicken rather than whatever the parents of that chicken were, right? Right? The first chicken wasn't conceived by chickens. It was conceived by a pre-chicken, right? You know, the first pair of 3-foot-tall Adamites on that world weren't conceived by 3-foot-tall parents. Right? This incredible variability potential in the reproductive process. You know, so you're not producing copies. You are reproducing. Right? And you can really see how different it can be from just a copy when you think about examples like this. You know, one day what hatched out of that egg was a chicken instead of whatever. You know, one day the children of two you know, primates were Adam and Infanta. Right? There's no in between. It can all happen in just from parent to conception. That there can be that huge jump. Right? Species originate in the process of conception, not through some gradual evolutionary process in an external environment thing. Okay. All right, what else do we have here?
4, the temperature types. It is possible to create living beings who can withstand temperatures both much higher and much lower than the life range of the Urantia races. There are 5 distinct orders of beings as they are classified with reference to heat-regulating mechanisms. In this scale, the Urantia races are number 3. 30% of Satania worlds are peopled with races of modified temperature types. 12% belong to the higher temperature range, 18% to the lower, as compared with Urantians, who function in the mid-temperature group.
Okay, so here you see it again. You have a very much, you know, a central group. In other words, that's the temperature range of an architectural world. And then there's variations to either side from the architectural world norm. Okay, just a very simple thing, just like the atmosphere types, just like the gravity types. You know, what that range is. You know, you notice how it's going to start to get kind of sparse. You know, they can't even really give you any hints. They're not allowed to tell you how much the temperature range can vary and stuff. They just leave that to your speculation.
They say much versus little.
Right.
Which makes you wonder, well, probably wouldn't go above boiling point of water is, it might be very hard for them to exist.
Right. See, that's where you start to think about it again, because, you know, if they're basically like us, you know, remember, non-breathers are a separate issue. But if they're basically like us, right, I mean, you can't have it 1,000 degrees Fahrenheit on the surface. That's not going to work. What about water? How does it work with water? Right, right. So you have these basic boundaries that they have to work within. But the fact that they can make non-breathers, as we're about to read about here, you know, there's probably some amazing creativity that they have, that they've figured out, you know. But
we don't fight over the thermostat anymore.
Yeah, you know, remember what they said here. Let's see, where was that? It is quite impossible for you to envisage the environment which prevails during the early ages of some worlds. So they are, you know, beyond the immediacy of what they're talking about there, you know, they're reminding you that there's a diversity on worlds that really you've never even imagined in your most wild science fiction. Okay? And the life carriers have the creativity to work with a lot of that variability. All right, let's see, I think that's all the basic there.
The life carriers are the same. They're not.
Yeah, there's another thing. Okay, great point. For those in the webinar, you're saying the life carriers are all the same. Again, remember, a life carrier has to be able to be modified to really match up with the life they're designing. So again, you can't have that life they're designing being radically all over the map. They couldn't interface with it. Again, everything is all of a basic type, because that's what the will, the infinite will, wants.
But will it be affected by the size of the planets or stuff like that?
But that's the whole point I'm making. I mean, the life carriers only have so much variability in what they can touch, literally, you know, and manipulate electrochemically, right? You know, they're obviously quite variable, but there's going to be limits to their variability, and they have to be able to be intimate with whatever they're constructing, right? So what they're constructing has limits. It's just as simple as that. All right, now this one gets really mysterious. Let's look at this one.
5, the electric types. The electric, magnetic, and electronic behavior of the worlds varies greatly. There are 10 designs of mortal life variously fashioned to withstand the differential energy of the spheres. These 10 varieties also react in slightly different ways to the chemical rays of ordinary sunlight. But these slight physical variations in no way affect the intellectual or the spiritual life.
Okay, so what they're telling us up front, they're not giving us any explanation of what they mean, but yeah, we know about the phenomenon that is called electric. We know about the phenomenon that is called magnetic. And by electronic, they mean, you know, where you actually have particle issues, right? You don't just have electromagnetic influences imposed, but actual particle influences. You know, for instance, like the solar wind, you know, is a particle stream coming from the sun slamming into the earth, right? That's not just, you know, electromagnetic stuff. I mean, that's actual particles. You know, so that's what I mean, the electronic level, particles, electronic behavior. You know, and they're saying not only the immediacy of the particle, but if the particle is a photon, right, you've got the waves associated with that as well. So they, you know, they mention, for instance, ultraviolet, right, photons, chemical rays of ordinary sunlight, that's ultraviolet. Right, so they're saying that's part of this too, the whole issue of how the life is designed relative to ultraviolet. We know that, you know, we're kind of sensitive, and a little bit too much ultraviolet, and we get seriously burned. Right? That doesn't have to be that way. They could design life that could handle incredible amounts of ultraviolet and not get burned at all. Okay? But we can't withstand, and so remember, not coincidentally, you know, it was constructed, the ozone layer was constructed, and it's maintained by the master physical controllers. You know, you could try to destroy the ozone layer, but guess what? You're going to fail, because it's not maintained by, you know, random processes. It was built and is maintained by the master physical controllers. Now, they do that seamlessly. You'll think it all just happens naturally, But it doesn't, right? As they tell you in the part three, right? Ozone layers are not a, you know, they're a construct. They're an art form, and they're maintained. Okay, so that whole issue of this electric, magnetic, and then particle, along with, you know, the waves associated with particles too, that whole energy environment, they have to deal with that. And what they're dealing with is, you know, they don't really help us understand. Just that there is that all that variation. And then the last point is very important. All the stuff we're reading about right now has nothing to do with variations of an intellectual or spiritual nature. We'll get to those later. Right now, we're just dealing with the variations of a physical nature, right? And variations that, I mean, all the adjutants basically seat on in, you know, basically the same way. They're pointing out that you can have all these variations like they're talking about, and the adjutants engage just like they engage you, basically. But there are other variations of mortals where that isn't the case, right? The intellectual and the spiritual nature is distinctly different, you know, when you go across those spectrums. Okay, and then the other thing about that, you know, when humans first started to try to imagine what makes us something besides a collection of molecules, you had all sorts of fanciful notions, you know, like with Frankenstein. You know, Frankenstein's monster, right? You know, thinking that if you just, you know, took that electric stuff, you know, and you know, hit it to a pile of molecules, you know, that it would be alive and it would be minded and all this, right? I mean, you know, so that's another thing that's, you know, in play there. Electric, magnetic, and electronic stuff doesn't give you mind or spirit, right? In some magical way, like humans have thought. All right, what else do they say here?
Of the electric groupings of mortal life, almost 23% belong to class number 4, the Urantia type of existence. These types are distributed as follows. Number 1, 1%. Number 2, 2%. Number 3, 5%. Number 4, 23%. Number 5, 27%. Number 6, 24%. Number 7, 8%. Number 8, 5%. Number 9, 3%. Number 10, 2% in whole percentages.
And wow. So no explanation of what this spectrum is, but they give you all 10 percentages. One can only speculate about you know, the why of all that. But the one thing that you can see, I mean, the 10 should have told you that up front. You know, we don't have a simple thing where they have like 3 or 5, and so we got a big central thing and then, you know, distinct tails on each side. You can see it does have, there's more in a central region and they tail off, but it's much more complicated. So, you know, see how it isn't speaking as much to, there's what you've got on the architectural worlds and then there's the slight variations from that. Right. This is all the, you know, the electric, magnetic, and electronic stuff is, you know, is all very definitively manipulated on the architectural worlds by the power beings. Here we're kind of just dealing with, you know, a basic sort of a middle that's kind of like that manipulated environment on the architectural worlds, you know, and then some big long tails. A variation off to the sides of that. You know, it's much, it's a much different sort of thing than the gravity or the atmosphere, right? I mean, you know, there just isn't really an electric, magnetic, or electronic environment, quote unquote, right, to the architectural worlds. Do you see what I'm getting at, right? I mean, you know, that's something when you're out in a space that's just doing whatever it wants to do, yeah, you know, that you have this sort of thing. So that's why you don't see the tight little spectrum like the other. So you get that much from it. That's what that broad spectrum is telling you. Now, one of the things you could wonder is, what are they doing? You know, are you know, the electric, magnetic, electronic, are the non-breathers here? I mean, you notice, curiously, it doesn't specifically say that this is in Satania. So you'd have to assume it. If it is Satania, you know, for this list, they mention it, you know, in the other ones, mm-hmm. you know. They specifically say in Satania, you know, it says whole percentages. You know, it's actually just under 1.5%, you know, 619. I mean, if you rounded to the nearest, that would be 1%. So maybe number one is them, but you know, I don't know. That may not be the case. Right? They don't give you any clues. It's all very mysterious. See what this variation is. We just really don't, you know. And I would think they could have explained this more, right? But obviously they weren't allowed to. I mean, they could have explained a little bit more exactly what they mean by electric environment and how it varies. I mean, they could have explained that to us. Yeah. You know?
Well, it must have something to do with how the master physical controllers, how the mechanical mind interacts with the material body.
Right. I mean, mechanical mind is going to be very, you know, I agree completely. Mechanical mind is going to have a lot to do with this. It's going to have a lot to do with the next types, too. Mm-hmm. Right. When you're talking about, you know, energy issues, that immediate energy interface of mechanical mind, you know, to the animated matter, right, is going to be involved in those issues. You know, and you notice that's why they say in no way affect the intellectual, right? It may affect the mechanical mindal, right, but not the agitant, you know, issues, right? Mechanical mind, you know, might be very different on the matter side of it, but it has a spectrum so that when it gets to the agitant side of it, you know, it can be what it needs to be for the agitants to basically see the same way they always do, right? So that's another reason why they, you know, why this is the case, is the agitant mind isn't directly related to the living matter. The clutch between the two of them is a mechanical mind. Right? All right. Maybe one other little thing to think about. You know, if it is Satania, these percentages, since we only have 619 instead of, you know, roughly 1,000, you know, these percentages would shift quite a bit. You know, when it's spread out over 10 bins like that, you know, another 400 worlds is going to shift things quite a bit. So you wonder, when all is said and done, you know, one of these maybe is going to be much more definitely a peak, you know, with tails coming off of it.
Mm-hmm. Do you think maybe the way that they have it set up here with, you know, the first group being a lower percentage and the last group being lower percentage that they're out on the fringes?
Yeah, that is definitely the case still. You still have some sort of a central region that's easy, you know, and then the farther you go from that, the harder and harder it gets for the life carriers to do it. So that there's just a handful of worlds that in some way are remote from the center, but are still within the, you know, the boundaries of possibility. You know, maybe another way to think about that, there's less and less potential flexibility the farther you go from the center. Things that are in the center can have all kinds of variation. There's plenty of potential for variability to match there in the center. But you get out to the tails, and there's maybe only one way that you can make life that's that remote from the center, you know, instead of 50 different ways. Like, there might be closer to the center, right? Oh, yeah. And this type would probably be a lot like that, you know, as opposed to atmosphere or gravity or thing, because, you know, this is obviously very complex, you know, right? And they've got you're an electrochemical thing. So, I mean, there's a limit to how much stress can be put on you electrically or magnetically without that messing up the way your body works, right?
Six, the energizing types. Not all worlds are alike in the manner of taking in energy. Not all inhabited worlds have an atmospheric ocean suited to respiratory exchange of gases, such as is present on Urantia. During the earlier and latter stages of many planets, beings of your present order could not exist. And when the respiratory factors of a planet are very high or very low, but when all other prerequisites to intelligent life are adequate, the life carriers often establish on such worlds a modified form of mortal existence, beings who are competent to affect their life process exchanges directly by means of light energy and the first-hand power transmutations of the master physical controllers.
Okay. And it's later stages as opposed to latter stages, but similar, close enough. Okay, so see what they're getting at here. We're talking about, you know, the actual issue of how your body has energy to power its processes, right? And fundamentally, you know, what's involved in that for us. You know, you need oxygen, right? It's the oxidization processes that are the fundamental means by which all the complex chemical things happen, so that you can store and deliver energy to where it's needed in this sort of stuff chemically. Right, so you know that's why they mentioned atmosphere, right? Because the oxygen issue. You know, so I mean, nutrition is not just about, you know, is what kind of stuff do you have to stick in a hole in your face. Right, but the atmosphere, the oxygen issue is involved in that fundamentally too. So that's why. So think about both those together. That's the point of this. And you know, at the end there, they point out that there are a lot of times when you can't just have some variation on the whole oxidization sort of chemical process that we're familiar with to be fundamentally how the beings are energized. You have to go outside of that basic concept and actually have the animals be a little bit more plant-like, right? And have a photosynthesis-like thing happening for the animals, for them to get energy directly from sunlight. Right? So that's, you know, by means of light energy. So that's one kind of radical variation they bring in. And then the other is they're being the creatures get energy directly from the master physical controllers. You know, the power beings feed them, as it were. Okay, and we mentioned that way back. You don't have to turn here, but I'll just remind you, way back in paper 29, when we were reading about the power beings, there was a little footnote paragraph in when they were talking about the energy transmitters. Okay, that type of master physical controller. It says these beings, you know, the energy transmitters, together with the energy transformers, remember those are the personal ones that could be, you know, directing something, together with the energy transformers are indispensable to the maintenance of mortal existence on those worlds having an impoverished atmosphere, and they are an integral part of the technique of life on the non-breathing planets. Right? So the sub-breather worlds, those mortals can't totally be an ongoing phenomenon the way we are. They need a little assistance from the power beings for energy input. Yeah, and then they point out, obviously, it's not just assistance, but full on for the non-breathers. See, an integral part of the technique of life on the non-breathing planets. Right? The non-breathers, all their energy input comes directly from the energy transmitters plugging into them and pumping energy into those creatures' bodies to power their metabolism, to power the processes in your body. You know, as opposed to you having exothermic reactions that dump heat into your body, you know, and you know, power everything that's going on.
So how are they supposed to get the fear and hunger thing
Right. You think about how, we'll talk about that in a minute here when we read about the non-breather worlds. It's a very different situation when you're so cared for, right, with the non-breathers. Okay, so there's that issue that sometimes they have to really rely on the power beings or photosynthesis-like things, some sort of converting photonic energy into chemical energy, and heat. All right, and what else do they say here?
There are 6 differing types of animal and mortal nutrition. The sub-breathers employ the first type of nutrition, the marine dwellers the second, the mid-breathers the third, as on Urantia. The super-breathers employ the 4th type of energy intake, while the non-breathers utilize the 5th order of nutrition and energy. The 6th technique of energizing is limited to the midway creatures.
Okay, so you can see how I said it's kind of like the previous one, that you have kind of a different sort of a spectrum here, and a broad spectrum. You have the mid-breather, sub-breather, super-breather thing that's... But then you have the variations on that complexify the situation. Marine dwellers literally having a very different type of energizing technique. And we just talked about the non-breathers. But then they throw in a real curveball, midway creatures, and they mean secondary midway creatures there. And we read that before. Back in, what is that, paper 38, and again, you don't have to go there, but I'll just remind you what we read there, when they said that the secondary, in section 9 of that paper, it says secondary midwayers are physically energized by the Adamic technique. Right? That's what we're talking about here, physically energized, not intellectually or spiritually, but physically energized. That's that 6th technique. And we'll read about that more when we get to the material sons and daughters. That bit again, the power beings are putting energy directly into material sons and daughters. When they're downstepped to an Adam and Eve, they're still getting energy from the power beings, but they need the fruit of the tree to help facilitate that linkage, right? That fundamental thing that they're not just, they don't get their energy just from eating food like we do. Their children do, right? But Adam and Eve themselves are getting some energy for their body directly from the power beings. And on Gerasim, they're not just getting it from eating food, they're getting a lot of their energy from the power beings directly. And it's that whole system that is overriding them aging and dying.
And that's what Van and Amidon did too, right?
Right, right. Their bodies were modified, right, so that they could be plugged in like this too, utilizing the fruit of the tree. There's some complicated physics to all this, but the whole point is to get the energy input from the power beings, from the energy transmitters. Yeah. So there's some fancy physics going on there. Okay, all right. So that's that other technique, and you can see why it's next to in the list the non-breathers. See, because those are the two that have this similarity of getting it from the power beings. Very very fundamentally, the sub-breathers, like they said, that's just sort of a the only way that you can make sub-breathers is if you bring in that little bit of addition. Right? But it's sort of secondary rather than primary, like it is for the secondary midwayers and the non-breathers.
These master physical controllers have a moral consciousness, and they have a rebel midwayer that they're helping to energize.
The energy transmitters are not personal.
Okay,
it's a good thing.
They're just a power plant, basically.
No, but their function can be cut off. Right.
Personal.
like it
But you know, but remember that, you know, that's not the way it works. I mean, if you go to iniquity, your guardian angel is still going to tend for you as if you're as you are today. Right? So they stay plugged in. So you think about how easy it would have been to prevent, rebel midwares. Just unplug them. But did they do that? No. No. Go ahead and get that last one in there.
Okay. Here. 7, the unnamed types. There are numerous additional physical variations in planetary life, but all of these differences are wholly matters of anatomical modification, physiologic differentiation, and electrochemical adjustment. Such distinctions do not concern the intellectual or the spiritual life.
So there's a bunch of variations that they're just not going to really talk about the specifics at all. They'll allude to that up in section 5 a little bit more. Some of this variability they're speaking of here. But again, they're stressing it's just physical, not intellectual or spiritual, impacting variations. And it's of all sorts of, it's in the gross, it's sort of the macroscopic physical variations, anatomical modification, more microscopic modifications of physiologic processes, way down in the details of the electrochemistry, electrochemical adjustment. So across the whole spectrum, having different organs than we have, that would be anatomical modification, those sorts of things. All right, so now everyone's been waiting. Let's read about the non-breathers.
Paper 49. I do get to breathe while I read this, right?
Yes, you do.
A couple times.
Depends if you want to get into character.
Especially between paragraphs.
Okay.
Paper 49, section 3, Worlds of the Non-Breathers. The majority of inhabited planets are peopled with the breathing type of intelligent beings, but there are also orders of mortals who are able to live on worlds with little or no air. Of the Orvantan inhabited worlds, this type amounts to less than 7%. In Nebadon, this percentage is less than 3. In all Satania, there are only 9 such worlds.
And they'll explain in a second why the percentages are going down there as you zoom in to our local system from the super universe at large. But notice the one little thing there. There are worlds that have so little atmosphere that you can't even make a sub-breather. Right? I mean, it can only be a non-breather. Right? So that little bit of incidental atmosphere, is just superfluous to the creatures.
Do they verbally communicate?
Again, it's pretty hard to jiggle air molecules when there's no air. Right? See, simple question. So how do they communicate? Mentally, just like you will in the mansion worlds. See, so again, just that one little thought. You can see how by nature, right from the beginning, a lot of things about non-breathers is kind of like what you have on the system headquarters worlds, right? Not so much like what we're used to.
No singing going on.
Right, there's no singing, in a jiggling air molecules way. But if you can hear me mentally, I can sing to you. Right? Yeah. And of course, it's not literally mentally, it's literally mindily, right? I mean, you're just connected through that energy system. You're going through the mind energy system directly rather than going from the mind energy system down to the material energy system and then back up to the mind energy system to communicate. So you avoid all of those downstepping and upstepping issues, but you also aren't grounded in the limitations of matter. Mind is, your mind is open to a lot of free will variation. And so it's...
But you could have one being communicating with a bunch of others.
Mm-hmm. Right. And you have to learn how to, if you don't want to communicate to a bunch of others, you have to learn how to make a focused point-to-point communication. But, we do that same thing. I might put my hands so only you can hear, right?
Like whispering in the theater.
Right, whispering and trying to create a funnel, you know, that kind of guides the jiggling air molecules just to you rather than beaming them all over the room, right? Yeah.
Just as long as they can't read your mind.
Yeah.
Right, and again, it's communication, so, right, it's not just, you're not an open book. Okay, but anyway, not to go too far afield there.
There are so very few of the non-breather type of inhabited worlds in Cetinia because this more recently organized section of Nerlashadek still abounds in meteoric space bodies, and worlds without a protective friction atmosphere are subject to incessant bombardment by these wanderers. Even some of the comets consist of meteor swarms, but as a rule, they are disrupted smaller bodies of matter.
You notice how they couldn't resist the opportunity to throw in a little comment about comets there. But see, so that's the main point, you know. You've got all kinds of micrometeorites, you know, constantly hitting a world. And that's going to be a problem if those micrometeorites don't burn up in the atmosphere.
Deflect.
Right, you'll be Swiss cheese in very short order, right? It's just going to punch you full of holes, you know. It's like being, you know, standing in machine gun fire. Right, you're just going to be fully perforated in short order. So that's the reason. And you remember how they tell you that the environment in our constellation is pretty vigorous, right? This is the rugged frontier energy-wise. So no wonder, you know, you go in Orvinton, there's going to be some pretty calm places. But as you zero down on this very energy-active region that we're in, you know, it's going to be hard to find a world that is going to work for a non-breather, even with what they're about to say here. Okay.
Millions upon millions of meteorites enter the atmosphere of Urantia daily, coming in at a rate of almost 200 miles a second. On the non-breathing worlds, the advanced races must do much to protect themselves from meteor damage by making electrical installations which operate to consume or shunt the meteors. Great danger confronts them when they venture beyond these protected zones. These worlds are also subject to disastrous electrical storms of a nature unknown on Urantia. During such times of tremendous energy fluctuation, the inhabitants must take refuge in their special structures of protective insulation.
Okay. Right, so right, so you got all these issues of evolution, and you notice they say advanced races, you know, so that immediately brings up, okay, so imagine a primitive race that doesn't have this advanced technology, right? I mean, they can't be out on the surface, right? So, you know, like I've said a number of times, you know, if there's got to be some degree of evolution, okay, of these creatures. You know, otherwise they wouldn't say advanced races, right? Right. So there has to be primitive races, you know, and just that whole point of, you know, here's these primitive races, and as they start to evolve, one day they go, I wonder who built this underground facility that we live in, right? I mean, one day, right? I mean, this is a very artificial place, see, where, you know, the power beings have built some elaborate subterranean places.
Like a hollow planet?
I mean, who knows what they're doing? It can't be, you know, too radically different from our world because it's not an architectural world. It is an evolutionary sphere. But, I mean, the surface at least has been radically engaged, you know, and so some sort of subterranean environments that these creatures are initially evolving in, the animals and the, you know, and the prehumans, and then the humans, and
so why bother? I always wondered. You know,
the reason why bother is, I mean, it's not just a delight of creativity that you can dream up a way to actually make mortals on these worlds. That may be kind of what motivates the life carriers, is the excitement of seeing if they can find enough creativity to make will creatures on a world like this. But when all is said and done, if you didn't make those will creatures, you could never produce the Supreme. The whole point, the whole point of supremacy of the supreme is it's a total expression of the finite. All finite potentials have to be actualized. This is a finite potential.
When I was a kid, they had a show, you guys are called Flash Gordon, you guys are probably too young.
I don't remember.
But they had the clay men on there that were kind of like non-breathers, remember? They would walk into the rocks and then they would walk out the other side. It was a human form.
Some of us are almost as old as you, John.
And they also had atmospheric men, too.
Yeah, I just was like
that. You know, you would, because they...
Yeah, so, I mean, right, I mean, obviously, as soon as we start talking about non-breathers, if you aren't thinking, if you weren't thinking science fiction before, you're definitely thinking science fiction now, right? This really gets your science fiction juices going. Now,
in relation to what John was saying, would it be correct to think that, you know, why go to that this extreme trying to, create some way for these people to evolve, for morals to evolve on these situations. And the would it be correct to say this must have to be because it's going to satisfy something, like you said, the supreme, of course the supreme, but even on up further than that.
Yeah, of course, right. I mean, and you'll see a reason for it here shortly, about why they need to be, when we reflect on, get a couple paragraphs forward here. But the one thing you got to bring out in here, this is there's a very huge paragraph, one little word, okay? When it says that they can make electrical installations which operate to consume or shunt the meteors. That word shunt is gigantic, okay? Right. The consume thing is, you know, it's like we imagine already, you know, where you have a quote-unquote force field, you know, and the little micrometeorites are coming in, you know, it's a bug zapper. They just get vaporized when they hit this shield, okay? But the shunt thing, the word shunt means that you're not working against the nature of the object, right? You know, it's a little mass coming in, and you're working against it, and just eliminating it as this incoming mass. Shunt means you're working with the nature of it. You know, if you shunt electricity, you're not trying to prevent it from flowing. You're trying to encourage it to flow. You're working with its nature, and directing it where you want it to go. Giving it a path of least resistance. You're working with it. To say that you're shunting meteors, a meteor is a mass. To work with it as a mass means they have electromagnetic installations that produce anti-gravity. Mm-hmm. Right? That's the significance of them saying shunt. That's proof that you can build an anti-gravity device, you know, with some sort of electromagnetic technology. Right? That's anti-gravity. Right. The non-breathers have anti-gravity technology, electromagnetically generated anti-gravity. Wow. That's the significance of the word shunt. Right. So if you've got a great big meteor coming in, you know, they just, you know, use gravity, you know, to it's like you go over here. Right. They don't try to just vaporize that thing, you know, by launching 500,000, you know, hydrogen weapons at it or something. Right.
Well, that's what it says with any big body that comes close to the Earth, the gravity would blow it up, even when the moon eventually gets here.
Right, but again, you don't want this big meteor coming in so close that tidally it gets ripped apart, you know, and rains even more. Right? They just, it stays intact, they just shunt it off to the side. Right? You know, so they have anti-gravity technology, you know, on a vast scale, right? I mean, where you are manipulating a remote meteor coming in, okay?
So they right. obviously don't have six centimeters.
So that's a huge thing. Well, then there's all these issues of how, you know, if they have Sangic races and all this sort of stuff. But, okay, let's read some more.
life on the worlds of the non-breathers is radically different from what it is on your ranch. The non-breathers do not eat food or drink water, as do the Urantia races. The reactions of the nervous system, the heat-regulating mechanism, and the metabolism of these specialized peoples are radically different from such functions on Urantia mortals. Almost every act of living, aside from reproduction, differs, and even the methods of procreation are somewhat different.
Okay, so think about the significance of that statement. Okay, I mean, obviously, right, there's no water because there's no atmosphere, right? Right, so you got to make them so they, you know, they can exist without water, including, it's like, well, how does that work with a body? I mean, we're mostly water as a body, right? See how radically different their body has to be. You know, and they don't eat food because power beings are feeding them, quote unquote. You know, they're just pulling that energy directly out of the environment.
Can't go on a date, just go out
to the morning. Okay, now, you know, notice how they're kind of alluding to these variations that we've been reading about. You know, like, you know, these issues of heat regulating mechanism and stuff like that. Obviously, they're going to be radical in all these, you know, a lot of these things we've been reading about. But why does it say, at the end, almost every act of living aside from reproduction differs? Why would that not be as different? Can someone answer the question? Of all the things that are going to be radically different, that can't be that radically different. Why? Because an Adam and Eve have to come to that world. And they have to give birth to non-breather children.
Wow. Yeah.
That mate with them.
Wow.
Who would want to?
That's a huge step
down. Right.
Hold your breath.
Yeah, not only step down, but step to the side. I mean, talk about, yeah. Right? Okay, see, so you know, they tell you that the non-breather worlds get, you know, all of the normal dispensations and everything. You know, there's a planetary prince that comes. There's going to be a corporeal staff, right, for that planetary prince. There's going to be a non-breather corporeal staff for that planet.
How much they have to modify their bodies in order to make them so that they could be there?
Yeah.
That's a lot of modification.
Right. Right. The non-breather thing, you know, just, it boggles the mind, right? So, you know, but where the rubber meets the road in terms of dispensations is, you know, it's the Adamic dispensation, right? That's why, it's aside from reproduction, right? Because you've got to be able to take some, you know, a creature that's not that different from us, a material son and daughter, and have them give birth to children that are different. But obviously they can't, you know, there's a limit to how different the children of an Adam and Eve can be. So that, you know, that's the fact that they have to be able to be genetically compatible and can, you know, procreate with those children of Adam and Eve. Very amazing stuff.
These are the kinds of things that make it hard to understand how the world's ever going to accept your ranch book.
It was not going to be the next 50 years.
Can't sell this to airheads.
Right. I mean, you know, no so-called sober scientist, you know, is going to, you know, accept this sort of apparently foolishness, right?
Yeah, they'd make the whole book a joke.
Right. Totally.
Yeah. Right. So,
that's the reason I'm so in favor of sending thousands of miles.
Yeah, and again, you know, you just think about the details. Even the methods of procreation are somewhat different. There's a lot of water-based liquids involved in procreation when I think about it. How in the heck does this work? Right, it's hard to even imagine how exactly this all works, right?
Yeah. Talk about that graphite trip. I'm
not sure if I really want to.
All right, let's keep going so we don't run out of time here.
On the non-breathing worlds, the animal species are radically unlike those found on the atmospheric planets. The non-breathing plan of life varies from the technique of existence on an atmospheric world. Even in survival, their peoples differ, being candidates for spirit fusion. Nevertheless, these beings enjoy life and carry forward the activities of the realm with the same relative trials and joys that are experienced by the mortals living on atmospheric worlds. In mind and character, the non-breathers do not differ from other mortal types.
Right, so mind and character, right? So there is enough of a clutch sort of an aspect, like we were saying, to the mechanical mind. The mechanical mind can interface with this radically different animated matter, but on the top end of that mechanical mind, the adjutants can engage, you know, the first adjutant, you know, immediately, can engage just like it does with you. Right? They have the seven adjutants just like we do. That's the mind part and character, right? You know, you have a temperament of your mere adjutant mind in the lower domain of the hourglass, right? You have a character of your, you know, of your spiritualized mind, of your personalized self in the upper domain, right? So they're encircled in the Holy Spirit, just like we are, right? On top of the seven adjutant mindedness. So in mind and character, the non-breathers do not differ from other mortal types. So even though their body is radically different, you know, the real you of them, right, their mindal self, is just like yours.
So they don't cry or shout for joy, but they feel it.
Right, they have all of the feelings and everything, emotions and, you know, and tragic deaths in the family and, you know, and you name it. Trees don't fall on them because they don't have trees, but a rock in the cave might fall on them and kill them or, you know, whatever.
If they go outside the shield, you know, they're pretty
right, close. If they go outside the, you know, if mom turns her back and the kid runs out the door out into the, you know, machine gun fire or the micrometeorites, you know, the little kid dies. Because mom, you know, wasn't paying close enough attention. And mom has to live the rest of her life with that, you know, just like here. Same sort of things as they're trying to get at, the same trials and joys.
Things would be somewhat quieter.
Things would definitely be a lot quieter. Yeah. Except, you know, in your head.
Is the animals we're talking about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yeah. You try to think about, you know, the survival of the animals before, especially if it's any kind of form of evolution like ours is, you know, where the planet's being bombarded and they, obviously, they are constructing things underground. Somebody's going to have to do that for them or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
You contemplate the concept of animals and,
really,
you know, yeah, they don't make any noises, air molecule noises.
Right, right.
It's kind of like, just to imagine the kind of animals. And would they have an atmosphere traveling animals? Because there's no atmosphere.
No, no.
You know, so
right,
it's kind of,
right,
it's
right, interesting. You don't have any water, you don't have any marine animals.
No.
You don't have any air animals.
And
no birds, no fishes.
They got to all be carnivore. Well, no,
okay.
They don't eat, do they?
Right, right, they don't eat. No, the animals are all fed by the power beings.
Right. Wouldn't we think of that as boring?
So we don't have to worry about the animals coming and eating them or biting them.
Well, yeah, but eating
right?
is such a great
That's
joy.
Kinda cool.
You don't
right.
have to eat.
So maybe they get along better.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Right.
But they got lots of flavors of energy.
Yeah, you don't have to worry about, you know, you're not going to have some religious movement that dreams up some future time when the lion lays down with the lamb, because there aren't lions.
They don't need to send
there are no carnivores, yeah, right? So think about how different their primitive religions would be, you know? But the main reason, you know, why, you know, to remind yourself, why do they have animals? It's not just because, you know, non-breathers need pet dogs too. Right? Why do they have animals?
For the adjutants.
For the adjutants, right? Because, you know, the only way for, you know, you to be using adjutant mind stably like you are is because you have animal species that most fundamentally those adjutants are seated on, right? And you are benefiting from their stable seeding on those adjutants. I mean,
yeah,
that's the main reason.
But it says that they experience the same relative trials and joys. I mean, mm-hmm, in our planet, eating alone is such a communal sharing thing that we experience. We don't just eat to stay alive. It's a lot more to it than that.
Right,
so they don't get that. They
right,
don't get to have that at
There's
all.
A key word in there, relative.
So they have something to replace it.
Right. They're going to have those sorts of things in some, you know, analogous way, just not directly, literally. They've got the exact same adjutant mind, you know, you do. Their adjutant mind can have the same range of emotions that you can have. It's just that those emotions are going to be stimulated in different ways than they are for us, right? There's going to be a full spectrum of pleasurable things that they do.
Of course there will be.
You know, and a lot of those pleasurable things, see, are completely beyond our imagination. That's, you know, and they're thinking, can you imagine how boring it would be to be on your rancha and to never experience X? This sublime pleasure that we all just delight in?
They wouldn't even understand what breathing is, right?
Mm-hmm. They don't miss it.
Or have to have a bathroom in your home.
Yeah. Right.
Guess so, there's trade-offs.
Yeah, so...
Can't use a vacuum cleaner to clean up.
One more sentence?
No. Before we get to that. Okay. The thing that Barbara brought up a minute ago about thinking about them in a bigger picture, right, about why there needs to be these beings. The candidates for spirit fusion line there, okay? Okay, so they're so radically modified that they can't, they have no potential to fuse with their thought adjuster, right? So they're all spirit fusers. And we talked about this when we talked about spirit fusers before. Remember the fundamental immediate point, purpose of spirit fused mortals is to populate the local universe with long-term inhabitants, right? So the spirit fusers are the ones that don't leave the local universe. You know, they're the long-term inhabitants of the local universe.
Even after the Supreme has...
Well, after the grand universe settled in life, no one knows anything, right? Everything changes then, but... But until the grand universe is settled in light and life, I mean, they're the permanent inhabitants of a local universe, all those spirit fusers. And so think about amongst all the different spirit fusers, right, there's this type of spirit fuser that has that particular type of relationship to the material level, and they bring that relationship to the material level up into the local universe as an ongoing minister within the local universe. I mean, that's, you know, when you'll finally understand why they exist, it's in that context. When you understand what kind of diversity you need for a local universe in and of itself, then you'll go, oh, the only way to get that kind of spirit-fused mortal is if they start as a non-breather, right? But all that stuff is, you know, currently beyond our understanding. But that's where you'll really understand why they are brought into existence. You know, is what you need to fill out all of the possibilities of the long-term inhabitants of a local universe. Okay? And this is the same thing about, you know, the children that are, you know, that are resurrected in the probationary nursery. You know, they become permanent, you know, citizens of the Isle of Paradise. Okay? Again, that's it's there that you, when you get to the Isle of Paradise and you see all the different permanent citizens of Paradise, you go, oh, Paradise wouldn't be complete if there weren't this type of Paradise citizen. Yeah. Yeah? And you'll understand exactly why the only way to make that kind of Paradise citizen is through that process. Right? Yeah. So it's, you know, always look to the sort of the destiny level when you want to really understand the purpose of something. You know, don't look to the process. You know, look to the destiny to begin to get a sense of the purpose. Okay, and then we'll finish it up with the zinger sentence here.
Hang on.
Oh, the question on the webinar? Okay.
Yeah, Chris, this is from Winston. Mm-hmm. What do you mean when you say the emotions are generated by our reaction to the adjutants?
Well, no, I mean, what I was saying is, you know, your emotional life is a reflection of the physics of the adjutants, right? They have the same adjutants functioning in the same basic way, you know, so those adjutants have the same range of feeling forms in them, right? It's just that those, you know, some of those forms will be stimulated into existence in their mind in different ways than they are for us. But the potential to have forms like that is there. And so, you know, there will be some means for the environment to stimulate them, you know, to produce those kinds of forms. You know, that's the only point I was just trying to make, you know. And just, you know, wondering, you know, what that is. When you think about the different kind of emotions, for instance, or just feelings, you know, that you could have, and how certain of those feelings are only stimulated in certain ways. It's like, well, what other way might stimulate a feeling like that, right? That's those areas for the non-breathers that they're going, how do those creatures exist without that? You see, they don't understand that you have another way to get that kind of a feeling. Right? You know, their way isn't the only way, just like your way isn't the only way to get that kind of a feeling, that kind of a pleasure. All right, yes, and then as I said, the final zinger sentence.
You would be more than interested in the planetary conduct of this type of mortal because such a race of beings inhabits a sphere in close proximity to your ranch.
That wouldn't be the moon.
Right, so, you know there isn't, an advanced civilization with a planetary headquarters and whatnot on the moon. Right? We'd know it.
We've never seen the backside.
Yeah, we have. Satellites, yeah. Right, so
it's all cheese.
The key thing here is, start with the first part. Okay, it doesn't say you would be interested. Okay, so this isn't just an intellectual curiosity. I mean, obviously, non-breathers is a very fascinating thing to think about. Okay, they're interesting, but why would they be more than interesting?
Really?
Okay, what? And not only are they, are they more than interesting, as it were, but it's not the conduct, it's the planetary conduct. So ask yourself a very, mysterious question. What does planetary conduct mean? What do they do, not just as people interacting with one another, stuff? Oh, you'd be more than interested in this particular custom they have. No, I mean, obviously, they're not talking about some sort of customs or something, their moray system or something, right? This is something that they do as a world. Planetary conduct is implying interplanetary. Right? People relate to other people on a planet. Planets relate to something like a planet, right? The subtext is, they're saying you'd be more than interested because there's some interaction between them and us. Right? A planetary conduct, like they come here and do things here. Right? And everyone knows, my speculation about this is, you have these mortals, right, that, there's never any mystery for these mortals. I mean, from a very early stage, they know there's a whole universe hierarchy of things. Like I said, I mean, the first thing is, I wonder who built these fancy Taj Mahal taverns that we live in, right? So from a very early stage, they are very aware of the whole universe hierarchy phenomenon and everything, right? They're very acclimated to that concept. Not unlike midwares, right? I mean, think about our secondary midwares. Are they thinking, well, I don't think there's any life on any other planets, and there's nothing, No, I mean, the secondary midwares, immediately have an awareness of a whole hierarchy of stuff. Primary midwares do. Right? So we had 1,984 secondary midwares, because this world needs that many very specific material helping hands. We lost all but 1,111 of them. What's going to make up for that? It's my suspicion that at some point in the not too distant past, the planetary administrators here went to this nearby world of the non-breathers and said, guys, we would like you to come and help us. We need some help. We need some volunteers to help. Right? And See, so it's very likely that's why we'd be more than interested in the planetary conduct. I mean, they come here, you know, and work with. No, we would if they, you know. And so you go, well, yeah, I mean, they're material. If they were here, you'd see them.
Yeah.
It's like, well, okay, well, what would they look like? Well, let's see. Most likely, right? I mean, if, you know, in close proximity, I mean, if they're, you know, this is not a remote solar system. That's not close proximity. It's going to be a world in the solar system. Huh, well, they told you there's 12 worlds to the solar system, and we've found 11 of them. I wonder which one is probably theirs, you know? And, right, you know there's got to be a world just outside the Kuiper Cliff. You got the Kuiper Belt that's being shepherded into an outer sharp boundary by a world that we haven't seen. It's like, well, why wouldn't we see it? Well, if they have advanced electromagnetic technology, all they'd have to do is just make sure photons don't bounce off of it and back to us. And
cloaking device.
Right, they can cloak the planet, basically. You know, not literally cloak it. I mean, you know, I mean, if you went there, you'd see it. Right?
What if they were opposite the sun?
Way.
Again, we've been opposite of the sun, right? Right, we have craft exploring. I mean, you know, and again, I mean, it's a world that's inhabited. You detect it gravitationally. And so again, just look through the solar system. There's no possibility, there's no gravitational anomaly in the solar system except one spot, exactly where the 11th planet ought to be.
Yeah.
Right? You got the outer planets, you know, in a nice order. Then there's one missing, and then there's the 12th. Right, and it's right there, just out. You know, it should be just outside of the Kuiper Belt.
And we don't see it.
Right. Most likely, that's the non-breather world.
Beyond Pluto.
You'd be more interested. Yeah, right. The next one beyond Pluto, between Pluto and Eris. Right, and you know, we're a dual inhabited solar system. Right, and they're working with the midwares. Right, so okay, so if that's where they're from, way out there where the sun is just a kind of a giant star in the sky, very dark out there. So what kind of eyes would they have?
Big.
Would you have tiny little eyes? So that you'd need a big eye to let in lots of light.
Oh, wow.
Okay, and they don't eat. They don't eat.
Yeah.
So would they have a mouth like us?
No.
No, they'd have a thin slit for a mouth. Yeah. Right. I mean, there's still a downstepped expression of material sons and daughters, so they're going to have the same bipedal eyes, ears, nose, mouth sort of natures like us, but okay, but their mouth is not going to be functional, their ears are not going to be functional, their eyes are going to need to be big. Do we have evidence of their existence? Yes.
Close encounters.
Right. Right.
No tongue to master.
Right. I mean, obviously
what
the most. It seems pretty obvious to me that the most commonly observed quote-unquote gray, are our non-breathers.
Yeah. Quote-unquote what, gray?
Gray.
Gray, quote-unquote the grays.
Grays.
The most commonly described grays. But now, remember, there's not just one species of grays that are described. There's a handful of different species, like maybe 9?
Mm.
Right? How many non-breather worlds are in our local system? You know, and they're spirit fusers. So, you know, they don't just live on a world and know they're going to be ascending up through this. They know that this is the local universe is their long-term place.
Right.
But they can't inseparate them to get here, right? They have to come by craft, right?
Right. They have advanced anti-gravity craft. The craft that we've observed, what kind of craft are they? Anti-gravity craft, we figured that out, you know, back in the 40s, in the 50s. Right? So who brought, you know, anti-gravity technology to the midwares, the secondary midwares on this planet? The non-breathers did.
Yeah.
How did they get that technology? Right? Before that, they developed airplanes and stuff, the secondary midwares. You know, and we have ancient evidence of people seeing airplanes in the sky and making little amulets of, you know, those were the secondary midwares that had developed airplanes by then. But then suddenly all that disappears, and the next thing you know, there's images of what look like grays, and there's anti-gravity craft. I mean, again, that's all obviously speculation, but
makes sense.
It's not very remote speculation. It all is just right there.
Yeah.
if you understand the revelation. Yeah.
Right.
But you don't see him hanging out all over. I mean, not like midwives or invisible, where there wouldn't be invisible.
Right, right. Right.
Quarantine.
But obviously something happened in 1947 where the word went out. Occasionally make your material efforts observable. Right? Overnight in 1947, everything changed. All right, so, so you have the grays. Those must be the non-breathers. And what's the other type of alien?
Flying saucer.
What's the other type of so-called alien? Nords.
Nords.
Big guys.
Which are the secondary midwares.
Right.
No, Nords aren't big guys. You know, if you saw, and you know, they're described as, you know, quote unquote aliens. They say, but yeah, if there was a crowd of people, you'd never even notice they were there, because they just look like a human. Unless someone pointed to them, and you go, oh my goodness, look how beautiful that human is. Right? What would the grandchildren of Adamson and Rada look like? The most beautiful human you'd ever seen. Right? That's right. See, so.
Those
right.
Who make themselves.
The Nords are the secondary midwares, and the Greys are the non-breathers. And the different species, the non-breathers have an interplanetary culture. You know, they travel between the non-breather worlds. Right? And occasionally we see others of the non-breathers. There's some short ones, there's some tall ones, and right? But then there's the main one that everyone sees. That must be ours. Those are our non-breathers. Yeah. So again, I mean, I can't prove any of that, but I just put that forward as a very enticing speculation. Because otherwise, explain to me why I would be more than interested in the planetary conduct. Yeah. Right? Right? If I knew that they were brought in to help out the secondary midwares, and occasionally we, you know,
interface.
Have evidence of them, right? You know, so again, think about this planet. You know, normally a planet's not made aware of the secondary midwares until light and life. Right? That's the normal thing.
Even though the Adam and Eve are aware.
Yeah, the Adam and Eve are aware, but the mortal, you know, the evolutionary mortals don't, you know, the two cultures aren't brought together until light and life. Normally they're two parallel cultures.
First they're secondary midwares.
Secondary midwares.
We are not aware of them until?
Normally the two cultures are not brought together until light and life.
Okay. Okay. Family.
Right, the secondary midwares. Right? That their culture is a separate culture from the human culture until light and life. Then the two cultures are brought together.
Shasta.
Okay. Okay, when you have more than one inhabited world in a solar system, long before anyone gets to light and life, right, those inhabited worlds are going to be interacting. And our other inhabited world is already interacting with the secondary midwares. So probably in the not-too-distant future, you know, the planetary governments are going to, you know, allow us to really come together, you know, and interact freely between the two inhabited planets. And the secondary midwares come along for the ride.
Well,
they already have anti-gravity technology and all this sort of stuff, right? If you're worried about us, you know, having problems in the future, I mean, it'll probably be fixed in the not-too-distant future. I mean, they'll have advanced medical technology and all kinds of stuff. We can fix all these issues in short order.
Good timing.
Mm-hmm.
So, really?
I've heard that we didn't get the Adamic uplift, and they're saying that alien abductions are a hybridization program.
Well, again, we don't want to go way off in a tangent with all that, but just, you know, notice the little essence. You know, there's in the stories, assume that a lot of the stories have a lot of foolishness in them, right? But say there's a kernel of truth to the stories. You know, would it be surprising if there's issues of the genetics on this planet? I mean, that's one of the most significant things that the planetary administrators are having to deal with, is our decaying genetics, right? We already know that they got permission to conserve the higher spiritual types, you know, the better genetic foundations on the planet. Right, so, it just opens up all kinds of fascinating speculation, right? But is it a coincidence that the book basically says there's two types of creatures similar to you that are actively doing physical things on this planet, and that we have stories of two different types of creatures doing physical things on this planet, that doesn't seem like it could be a coincidence. Yeah. Yeah. Especially when they look like what those two creatures should look like. One of the creatures should look like the grandchildren of Adamson and Rod, and the other creature should look like non-breathers, with non-functional ears and mouths and noses, right? They just have, you know, these, yeah.
So those beautiful ones, they're just amongst us, and we're not, but we don't notice it? I mean, they're not like
they're
people.
They're not always visible.
They
don't have to make themselves visible.
Okay.
But if they do make themselves visible, they're just going to look like a human.
And, right? And they're not, apparently I was wrong, they're not giant.
Yeah. Anyway,
glasses for sunglasses.
Right, we could spend the next 6 hours talking about this stuff, right? Right, because it's very exciting, and there's lots of things I could say because I've spent a lot of time thinking about it. But just, you know, recognize that it's extremely unlikely that there are aliens, right? But it's very likely that there's secondary midwayers and non-breathers from the other planet in our solar, inhabited planet in our solar system.
Yeah, it is.
Right? Right? I mean, think about what the secondary midwayers think of it being called aliens. It's like, what do you mean aliens? We're the actual inhabitants of this planet, not you. Right? You're the here today, gone tomorrow creatures.
Yeah.
Right? This is actually our planet, and we're just letting you use it for a little while.
What about quarantine?
That's their perspective. Yeah, and right, and they're under the same quarantine that we are, and because of course a bunch of them rebelled too. But then you got the whole issue. It's like, well, probably there wasn't a planetary rebellion on the other inhabited world in the solar system. That prince and that Adam and Eve probably hung in there.
They could be a lot further along.
Pretty handy.
Yeah, they are quite a bit further along. They have anti-gravity technology.
I want to ride one of those.
Well, they're not going to be much older necessarily, you know.
Yeah, we're a dispensation half behind.
They're not quarantined.
They could be the same age. They could be way.
They're going to be kind of in the same ballpark. But you're right. I mean, they don't have maybe as much of a drawn-out evolutionary process, you know. But, yeah. Anyway.
Million years.
You know, right.
Real fast question. If the quarantine, if they're not quarantined,
the system is under quarantine. Their planet might not be.
The whole system.
Right, the whole system is under quarantine, remember, you know.
Okay. So, and they're in the system, so they're off.
Right.
Did you say how could they come here?
No.
All right. Okay, we got to wrap it up. Okay. All right, so everyone, so the fun stuff is always the non-breathers, yes. And so next time we will get into a little bit more of this, and they'll go beyond just immediate physical stuff, right? All those issues of intellectual and spiritual will come into play too. All right, let's take a moment.